accession number 27208, Reel 3.
Bill Reid, Reel 3. So what happened after you'd left Yeovilton? Where were you posted to then?
To the Orkneys. To an airfield called Twat, which everybody laughs when you tell them what it's called. But it was a perfectly sensible airfield, one of two in the Orkneys, the other one was Hatson. And it was the home of 771 Squadron, which had the task of doing exercises for the fleet, which was based in Scapa Flow. And so you did target towing for the gunners of the fleet. You did dive bombing onto the fleet. You did radar exercises so that the radar operators on the ships could tell you where to go and see on the radar screen that you're doing the right thing. They were telling you the right thing to do. That sort of thing. And that's.
How did you feel about being posted there? Were you happy about that? Obviously not.
Not very happy, no. But you know, do what you're told. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was a very, very interesting experience. Very.
I was going to say, can we talk a little bit about some of those roles that you would have? Because obviously, what did it entail? Obviously, with the target towing, what would you do while you were towing targets for the fleet?
Oh, well, there were various ranges around the Orkneys which were designated as areas for people to shoot at targets. And you would fly, as far as I remember, yeah. Anyway, you flew over ships which wanted to do target practice, with a drogue behind you, towing the drogue behind you, and you hoped that the gunners were reasonably accurate and they would shoot at the target.
I was going to say, was there an element of danger in that? In doing
well,
that?
Yeah, there was a bit, really, but nobody got shot down, but it wasn't really the most pleasant thing that you had to do.
And what about the kind of radar? Was it radar calibration you were doing for them,
yes,
in a sense?
Yeah.
What would that involve, a flight? What would you have to fly a certain course or do,
yes,
certain actions?
You were in touch by radio with the radar operator on the ship, and he would look at the screen and tell you to fly in such and such a vector, and then turn and fly at such and such another vector. And most of them seemed to do it quite well. But there was one time when I was happily being vectored, and this chap vectored me out of Scapa Flow to the east. And he'd obviously lost me, but I didn't realise he'd lost me. And I turned round to come back in from the east, and of course all hell broke loose, because nobody's supposed to come in from the east on an airplane, except the Jerrys, you see. But they didn't actually shoot at me, thank God.
And what aircraft were you flying while you were up there?
Oh, these peculiar ones that nobody else would fly, I think. There was the Rock and the Skua, and I think the Martinet, and Swordfish and the Gladiator. I think these are the main ones, as far as I remember.
Can you tell me a little bit about each one of those? Give me a kind of thumbnail sketch of each one of them. What was the Rock like?
I think the Rock, as far as I remember, I'm not quite sure which was the one with the observer. I think that was the Rock. But the Rock and the Skua were very much the same, as far as I recall. They both had very long undercarriage legs, which made landing awkward. They were underpowered. They did not fly anything like as nicely as a Spitfire or a Hurricane. and they had an unfortunate arrangement of gearing in the engine, where you only had two propeller settings, either coarse or fine, and you took off in fine pitch, and they were not, as I say, they're not terribly overpowered by any means, but you got off the ground, and once you'd got up to a reasonable height, you then put it into coarse pitch, and the whole aircraft would shudder like this, and it would go into coarse pitch, and you think you used to think the engine had stopped, but it hadn't actually. Terrible aeroplane, both the rock and the skewer. They both had that feature, I'm sure, and they both had these great long undercarriage legs, which meant they're difficult to land and difficult to taxi as well, because again you had this great nose in front of you, so taxiing was awkward. Didn't like them.
Would you carry somebody with you in both of those aircraft at all?
Oh dear, again, you carried two certainly in one of them. I think it was the rock. I think you didn't carry another in the skewer, as far as I remember, but I really don't remember.
And you said they were underpowered. Was there anything else? Did they have any other vices at all, really?
I wouldn't have liked to get into a spinning one, because I don't think they were aerodynamically sound. It never did, happily. But the combination of underpower and poor aerodynamics means that you can easily spin an aircraft like that.
And what would they be used specifically for? Would there be one of the kind of duties that you were doing that they would be used for? Or would they be used as kind of all trades, really?
I think they were used for... don't think we used them for target towing. I think that was the martinet we used for that. I think it was just... I think it was mainly dive bombing, actually. They were fundamentally dive bombers. They had these great flaps, and they could certainly go down. It felt as though you'd been down vertically when you were doing dive bombing practice with them, because they had these great flaps, and closed the throttle and put the nose over, and you could see the ground coming up like this.
Would you practice dive bombing at that time?
Well, we were doing dive bombing on ships in order to give the gunners practice and training the guns on you.
You mentioned also that you flew the Gladiator.
Yes.
What was that like as an aircraft?
Delightful. That was a very most maneuverable aeroplane I ever flew. Really, very, very nice aeroplane.
Give me a kind of thumbnail sketch of what it looked like, what it was like, the characteristics, that sort of thing.
Well, I've thought it was a well-designed, well-built, very nice, robust, sensible aeroplane. It had plenty of power. You could turn it on a sixpence. You could do all sorts of manoeuvres with it. You could do flick rolls with it. If you pull the stick back and put hard rudder, I think it would do. And goes whipping round and do a flick roll, which I haven't had to do with many aeroplanes. You could do it with the Gladiator. And it was a delight to fly. Pretty nice aeroplane.
And of course you were flying the Swordfish as well.
Yes.
What was that like to fly?
Well, it always seemed to me to be a rather great big clumsy aeroplane. It was very slow. It was a bit of an old granny in a way. It was gentle. It wasn't so manoeuvrable as the Gladiator by any means. It wasn't meant to be, I don't suppose. But I never had to drop torpedoes from it, thank God. We just trundled around doing... I forgot what we did in them. Can't remember what we did in the Swordfish. I remember flying it. But the nicest story I like about the Swordfish was one I didn't hear till long after the war, when Peter Masefield was giving a talk on the occasion of Sopwith's 100th birthday, I think it was, and among the stories he told was the fact that he started in aviation in Ferry's design office. And as a raw apprentice designer, his job was to design the bracket upon which the bell would be hung in the event, on the Swordfish aircraft, in the event that the aircraft came down in the sea and the crew could ring this bell for help. And that was the Swordfish, a granny airplane.
It's much larger, I think, than people imagine, isn't it?
Well, it's a big airplane. Mm. It has to be to carry a big torpedo, you see. It has to have a lot of lift.
Did it have any vices at all?
Well, just dead slow, that's all. Compared to what you were expecting, airplane. I'd forgotten the speed, something like 110, 120 knots, I think, that's all it used to do, as far as I remember. Used to use it for photography, remember? Because it was a steady platform for camera.
And what about operating from the Orkneys? I imagine there are a few problems operating with conditions in the Orkneys.
Well, I was there again, and they seem to always finish up in the wintertime places, but I was there in the wintertime, and it was quite... well, it's not the sort of weather you go up there to get a nice holiday. I remember one time, for instance, trying to get from our bedroom, our hut, to the wardroom for a meal, and we couldn't get there because the wind was so strong against us. We literally couldn't walk against it. And we used to, in the winter time, it was very cold and, of course, very windy, very often. And they had each sleeping hut had a stove at the end of it, and these stoves used to get red hot because people used to bung in lots of fuel and make things red hot. Even then it was jolly cold, but I enjoyed it. I liked the Orkneys anyway.
In conditions like that, where were the aircraft stored? Because obviously
they had hangars. There's a proper airfield, hangars and a control tower, which is wrecked but still there, I believe.
And what about the weather conditions for flying? Could you fly all the time, or...?
Most of the time, as far as I remember. Hmm. It didn't get much fog, I don't seem to recall. Of course, it's winter time. But a lot of strong winds, a lot of rain. Yeah.
Because I think in July of 44 you returned to Yeovilton.
That's right, yes.
What had happened there? What was the posting back to Yeovilton?
Well, I think they probably ran out of people and decided that I could go and have another go, so I had another go. And I made it that time.
Was there anything different between the two courses that you'd attended, or was it a different...
I think it was just that I was a year older, actually, and a bit more mature. Not sure what it was.
Was it at this stage that you practised... the actual carrier landings on HMS Rowlandshire?
Yes.
What does that entail that's different from obviously the practice ones that you did on the runway?
Well, it's for real. And you've got the superstructure of the carrier on your starboard hand, so you've got to be a bit careful about not hitting that. And you've got the barrier, which, as you will know, I'm sure, that at that time there were the landing wires which were designed to catch the hook attached to the back of the aeroplane so it slow it down. But if it didn't catch these wires, the aircraft landed and the hook bounced over the wires, which was perfectly possible and did happen, then there was a very heavy steel hawser about 6 or 8 feet high, I guess, stretched across the deck in front of these wires about two-thirds of the way down the ship, and you simply hit that going at quite high speed. And that had to be there because the only place they could park the landed aircraft was the front of the vessel, so they had to have something between these aircraft, these parked aircraft in front of the vessel and the aircraft landing on behind it. Not a very satisfactory system, but it had to be done because nobody had invented any of the angled flight deck, or the ships weren't big enough to park them as they can do now on the sides of the vessel and allow landings to take place right across the whole deck.
Were you practicing again with the Sea Fire?
Yes.
I've heard that that was sometimes prone to bounce because of its kind of light weight.
Yes, it was a light airplane, comparatively.
Did everything throughout the training, did it all go well, or were there any accidents during the training period?
There were quite a few accidents. One chap went over the side. I think, yes, he was rescued. An aircraft broke its back. So I think somebody went into the barrier. I say we started off with about four and we finished up with one, as far as I remember.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you approach a carrier?
Yeah, we were taught that you do a curve of pursuit and keep the round down part of the deck, after part of the deck, and in sight and curve round onto it, which is necessary, especially in the case of the Sea Fire, because of the poor view, especially when you're approaching at a low speed and the nose is very high. You just came on the downwind leg, you positioned yourself on the downwind leg at a suitable distance from the ship, and as far as I remember, when the back aft end of the ship became a beam of it, then you started this curve. And the ship, of course, was moving forwards, but not very fast, and you curved right the way around, the idea being to straighten up just as you crossed the round down at the back end of the ship. And it seemed to work moderately well, but I found that I didn't have the trouble landing the aircraft or seeing so much as other people complained about, and I didn't quite know why that was until the commander flying said, you realise that what you're doing is to come in with a bit of rudder on. What I was doing involuntarily was to come in with a little bit of drift, which was able to move the nose over to the right, and I could see the deck and the bats much more clearly that way. Not perhaps desirable, because it could precipitate a stall, but nevertheless it worked very well.
So you were doing carrier training, and you said there's a certain number of... Were you quite confident with this carrier training, landing on the deck?
When you're young and stupid, you don't really appreciate that what you're doing is a bit dangerous, really. And it was quite dangerous. But nevertheless, it was good fun. It's something you try to do as well as you can. And in general, most people achieved it successfully. But I remember one thing that impressed me a bit about how the Navy wasn't altogether happy with modern airplanes was when they decided it wouldn't be a bad idea, somebody in authority decided it wouldn't be a bad idea, and heard that it was quite a good idea to take off with 25 or 20 degrees of flap to increase the lift over the wings. And the Sea Fire had two flap positions, flaps up or flaps down. They were pneumatic and they were either up or down at 90 degrees. So what they used to do in that case was, when you were waiting for the takeoff order, a couple of sailors would come out with chocks. One sailor on the right-hand side of the aircraft and the other on the left. You would be invited to put your flaps down, which you did, and then when the sailors had positioned the chocks under the rear of the flaps, you were invited to put the flaps up. So you put the flaps up, and the chocks were then trapped between the flap and the undersurface of the wing at, one hopes, about 20 to 25 or 22 degrees, and one hopes even more that they were both at about the same angle, and one hoped even more that either one or other didn't fall out during the landing run, the takeoff run, which could have been a total disaster. And the whole thing's quite extraordinary, but of course at that time it was just normal practice. Somebody in authority had said do that, so he did it and just got away with it. But I don't think you do it now.
What about taking off from the carrier when you were practicing with the Seafire? Because obviously you mentioned the poor visibility. Did that present a problem when taking off from the carrier?
No, not really. There was a little problem. Remember, there's a little bit of a problem with torque. You had to, I think, I can't honestly remember whether it's like right or left rudder, but you had to use heavy rudder in the initial part of the takeoff. I think it was left rudder, because the aircraft swung violently, or would tend to swing violently to the right, because of the torque of the engine in the initial stages of the takeoff run. So that's tiresome, but you got used to that.
So what happened after you'd done all this, the fighter conversion course, and you'd done your deck landings? What was the next move then, were you?
Well, we went to squadrons, those of us who had finished our training, and I was sent to 896 squadron, which hadn't any aeroplanes, but we had to go out to South Africa to pick up these aeroplanes, and they were not Seafires, nor were they Hurricanes, they were Hellcats. And so we embarked on a dreadful ship called the Kosciuszko. We had been intending to go on the Monarch of Bermuda, which is a charming ship, but that went unserviceable, and we were dumped onto this dreadful old, what seemed to be one up from a tramp steamer, to go out to South Africa by way of the Suez Canal. And so we did, and we got there to South Africa, and then we did our working out training at a place called Wingfield, an airfield which is now, I think, a housing scheme on the outskirts of Cape Town, and started flying Hellcats.
Again, a different variation from the number of aircraft you've flown before. Obviously, a powerful American naval fighter.
Yes.
Can you let me know again the characteristics of the Hellcat that made it different from other aircraft you might have flown?
Well, I do understand that Grumman, who made the Hellcat, had a very good liaison with the people who actually flew the aircraft for which they were designed. And so the feedback that they had from pilots in the previous Grumman aircraft was such that they made the Hellcat a very good airplane indeed. It was robust, it was tough, it had a Pratt & Whitney double wasp engine, which was as strong as a horse. It was a very good airplane indeed. I was very privileged to fly it.
Visibility?
Much better than previous aircraft. Much better than the Corsair. But it's never perfect. But it was good.
What was the armament like on the Hellcat?
Oh dear. As far as I remember, it was, I think it was either it was .5s machine guns. I think it was four each side. From inside 0.5 machine guns. We made a pretty hefty rattle when you'd set them off, or a 500 pound bomb, or rockets and just lying under the wings. I've forgotten the number. For each side, I think.
And what about its range? Was it different from, say, the Seafire?
Much greater range. Seafire had only about an hour and a quarter. A Hellcat that I've forgotten now. Certainly a lot more than that, more than double that.
Would it carry drop tanks for extra fuel if you wanted it to?
I didn't ever know anything about that.
When you were working up, were there any kind of vices that the aircraft demonstrated at all?
Not that I remember.
These much more powerful naval fighters, though, I take it, though, with something like spinning, you'd have to be very careful with that sort of thing, as you mentioned with the Harvard, the distinction between, say, the Harvard and the Tiger Moth. Would these fighters, would it be a problem getting into a spin maybe with them, or would it be the same kind of principles?
Well, they would have come out all right, but it was not desirable to get into a spin. I never had to do it, never did it, as far as I remember. told Hoodsy, as far as I remember, all the time. But I don't think we did spinning on Hellcat.
And you were working up as a squadron in South Africa,
yes,
were you?
Yes. It's really a matter of formation flying and training in air firing, training in use of the armaments, training in rocket firing, training in air-to-air combat.
Can we take each of those along a little bit and just say, you said obviously training in with air firing, for instance. What would that entail? What would you be? What would your targets be?
Oh yes, I remember. We had a firing range, and we. Was that in India? Anyway, the firing bit was certainly, we would go to a designated range of targets on the ground and dive down and fire at them with our guns. And I remember this particularly because after we had left the area, if you look back, you could see people rushing out of the woods nearby, picking up the spent cartridge cases. Yeah.
What about rocket firing? Is there anything you have to know about with rocket firing that's sort of different from firing of just the machine guns?
Yes. Don't wait too long. They seem to be. They could splinter, I think. I seem to remember because I did that once. I wanted to be very accurate with this on the target, and I left it a bit late. And so the rocket as it hit the target splintered and damaged my aircraft, which wasn't very clever.
How would you release the rockets from the aircraft?
As far as I remember, I keep seeing it, there was a mechanism on the control column, a trigger on the control column.
Would it allow you to release them singly or in pairs or all at once?
I don't remember, I'm sorry to say.
And formation flying, what kind of formations were you flying in? What were you training on? What types of formation?
Well, usually Vic formation, line abreast, line astern, usually with 3-4 aircraft. Occasionally with more. I think we had about 12 aircraft. But usually formation with a small number of aircraft, and usually the big formation, you know, the leaders in front of them and the wingmen left and right of them, just behind the side. That's the usual thing, I seem to remember. Line astern when you were approaching the carrier too, I think, and you broke off one at a time, came in one after the other. Yeah.